I know in one show there had to be a national anthem for some Ruritanian sort of country in Middle Europe, you know. And I composed this national anthem. Then when Spike heard it, he said, no, that sounds much too good. He said, I just want to hear one instrument at a time. So it sort of kind of started with piccolo, and then it went to trombone, and then it went to violin or something. And he was absolutely right. It sounded fantastic. I'd like to think I composed it that way, you see.
No one has had the courage.
To Goompod. This week I am joined by somebody whose name has been invoked a lot in recent episodes on Goompod. It is the gentleman who has been doing the Lord's work for the Goon Show Preservation Society, in as much as he has completely revamped, well, essentially made a brand new website for the GSPS, and he is Duncan Gray. Hello, Duncan.
Afternoon, Tyler. It's good to be on. I think it must be about 2 years since we first discussed doing this, but things have moved on since then.
How long was it? Is it 2 years since you started working on the website?
No, it's only a year ago I actually started working on the website. I blame you for the whole thing, by the way.
Why is that?
The Goon Show Preservation Society. As you know, last year was the 50th anniversary. And I had spent almost 50 years not being a member. And then you come along with your podcast encouraging people to join up. And and I did. And I discovered it doesn't actually cost much. So I did. And the first magazine I got, there was a story about the annual general meeting and a long discussion about what to do with the website, and there was a request for a volunteer to take it on. And I have a bit of experience as that at an amateur level, and I thought, this is going to be me, isn't it? And about 6 months later I had the job.
I didn't realize that. Or maybe you've told me, I'd forgotten. I didn't realise that you joined the GSPS off the strength of this podcast.
Yes.
Had you ever been a member?
I'd never.
Like when you were younger?
I'd never been a member. I was aware it was there, but the times I'd looked at it, there didn't seem to be much in it for someone living in Scotland who wasn't going to travel much, so...
Oh, you're Scottish.
I'm Scottish, yes.
I thought you were Welsh with your heavy Welsh accent.
Oh, right, okay.
Sorry. Now, which part of Scotland are you in, Duncan?
Oh, I'm just outside Glasgow.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the website, I think it's fair to say most people agree that the what was there before you came along, the GSPS website was fairly tired looking and dated.
It was very similar to a thing I had done for another organisation, which was just around the turn of the millennium.
And it's at goonshow.org, I think that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the best name I could find that hadn't been bought up by speculators, and they weren't going to pay for buying a better address, so that's what we got.
Okay, so, Duncan, in terms of your history with the Goons.
This is where most guests talk about how their father introduced them and so on.
Yeah.
And nothing like that. There was, I don't think in our home we heard any radio comedy at all until I discovered, I'm sorry, I'll read that again, probably the very late 60s. It just, radio comedy wasn't a thing. Then in mid-70s, I was at university and a friend of mine had made a couple of comedy tapes, and one of them was a couple of goon shows. They were the EMI, from what was they copied off the EMI disc, which had been released quite recently with the Red Forts and Missing 10 Downing Street.
With the annoying fake stereo.
Well, effect. That went over my head because I was a poor student and I only had a mono tape player.
Okay, yeah.
But yes, that's so, that, and so that's what he gave me. And hello, Robert, if you ever listened to this. Later, the tapes started appearing for sale and the CDs, and I started buying them and the Goon Show compendium and the script books. And then eventually the internet started, and there were sort of discussion groups I got involved in. So,
okay.
All went on from there.
Okay. But aside from the actual Goon Show, were you particularly fond of, you know, Spike on TV, Sellers Films, Highway even?
I'm not a Highway fan, no. I I'd enjoyed the Pink Panther films. The one film that always struck me was Dr. Strangelove.
Okay.
Not because it was Sellers. In fact, the first time I saw it, I probably didn't appreciate that it was Sellers or that he was playing all those parts. I was just at an age where I was aware that this Cold War was going on, maybe mid-60s, I suppose. And sure. The whole story had a bit of an effect.
Funny, with Strangelove, because I saw it for the first time when I was about, I'd have been about 14 or 15. So that's the late 80s, very late 80s. And where I was growing up, where I was living at the time, other side of the world, the Cold War barely caused a ripple on my radar. You know, a 15-year-old boy living in New Zealand in the late 80s. And I didn't really know anything about the Cold War. Technically, we were still, you know, the Soviet Union still existed, but I didn't know anything about the Cuban Missile Crisis or any of that at that time. So when I watched Dr. Strangelove, because I was keen on Sellers, it fell a bit flat for me on my first viewing because I didn't really understand it, you know. It's only in subsequent years as an adult, and I actually went on to develop a really significant interest in Cold War history. So I learned and read a lot and watched a lot of documentaries and films and things like that. So watching it as an adult, Strangelove, it's become one of my favourite films, of course. But yeah, when I was a teenager, I liked the German scientist with the funny voice and the funny arm. But that was about it, you know?
Yes, and lines like, you can't fight in here, this is the war room. But
even though I remember being a very arrogant teenager, thinking, oh, that line's a bit obvious, isn't it? I remember thinking that. I mean, who the hell was I to try and critique the comedy of Dr. Strangelove at that age?
Yeah.
Okay, so today you've come along to talk about a particular Goon Show. Is it your, I know the reason, which we'll come on to the reason why this particular show, is it your favourite Goon Show, or do you have another favourite Goon Show?
It's certainly not a favourite. It's not a top 50 favourite even.
Oh, really?
I don't think. I mean, it's still a very good show. I mean, I thought there was an interesting story behind it we could no doubt get into.
Yes. It is one of my favourites of all time. I'll hold my hand up and say, and I think it gets unfairly overlooked. And it's a very interesting show for reasons that we will come on to. So do you want to set the scene in terms of the reasons why you chose this particular show?
Well, what happened a good few years ago, the thought occurred to me, I wonder if there was a Goon show made the week I was born, because I'm a bit older than your average guest on here.
Yeah.
So I went into the Goon Show and Companion and looked, and there we go, Series 7, Episode 6, that's the week. It's The Sleeping Prince. Except there's a note, an asterisk and a note saying that it wasn't broadcast that week because of the political situation at the time. The story involves a revolution and the Hungarian uprising was going on then, and so it got canned until a later date. And they played the Greenslade story, a repeat of that instead, which I would have enjoyed if I'd heard it. But
yeah, so ever since I got the Goon Show Companion, I've been aware of the fact that The Sleeping Prince wasn't broadcast when it was meant to be broadcast because of the Hungarian uprising. I'm sure there's people out there listening to this who have never heard of the Hungarian uprising. Do you want to quickly sort of run through what that involved, what all that was about?
Okay, so we're back into the Cold War again. But back in those days, there really was a heavy repression by the Russians and all the other countries of the Warsaw Pact, as it was, those ones east of the Iron Curtain. And there was, of course, resentment in those countries. Then the story probably really starts in 1953 when Stalin died. And there was a bit of fighting for the leadership, and Khrushchev finally gained power. And then early in 1956, he made a secret speech to the party convention, slagging off a lot of what Stalin had done. But it's a secret that was very quickly spread around the world. It got leaked. And in Hungary and other countries, they got the idea that, okay, maybe this repression is going to be a lot easier. And they started pressing for reforms. Unfortunately for them, Perestroika was still 33 years away. But they were allowed an election, and a government came in with Mr. Nagy in charge, who'd been a long-standing...
I believe it's pronounced Imre Nagy.
Nagy, okay.
Nagy, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds fair. So, Nagy. And I pretty probably believed he had some power. But then there was more pressure for reforms, some demonstrations. Some students demonstrated outside the AVH, which was the Hungarian version of the Stasi. They got arrested. More students protested. They got shot. And the whole thing descended into a civil war, which got rather bloody.
Yeah. And then the day that the goons assembled in the Camden Theatre to record The Sleeping Prince, although it wasn't called The Sleeping Prince, but we'll come to that. The day that they were due to record was the day, I believe, that the Soviet tanks rolled into Hungary.
For many days, the fighting continues with now the government, now the insurgents gaining the upper hand. Running battles move from street to street. But as the toll of dead and wounded grows heavier, it becomes clear that the rebels must win, for they have the great mass of people behind them. Desperately, Imre Nagy's government seeks a way out. A few days ago, it had asked the Russians to help. Now it begs them to leave. But some of the Soviet tanks will never leave, for they have been captured or destroyed by the insurgents they were ordered to quell.
Yes, Nagy had made a declaration that Hungary was now independent, and he was calling on the West for support, and that was the last straw, and which was, as you say, the same day as the Goons had a recording of the show, the sixth episode of Series 7. It was a sort of much the same, if you think back to Foiled by President Fred, which I know you discussed it previously.
Yeah, and by the way, I'd forgotten the similarities in themes between that. And I'd also forgotten that because I think I said in that episode when I did Foiled by President Fred that the General Aston Villa voice that Sellers did was a one-off or something along those lines.
Yeah.
When, of course, it turns up in this show.
Just to confuse matters, yes.
Yeah.
But, same as Foiled by Fred and President Fred, Neddy is getting sent to South America where there's a revolution going on. Except that there must have been something in the air that warned that this wasn't really going to work, such a theme of story about a revolution that week. And I've had a look at the original script and there were a lot of changes made, I'm guessing, on the day.
Well, for a start, one of the fundamental changes was that the story, the script, the show was originally to be called The President's Protocol.
Yeah.
Which is a very almost like a sort of Eric Ambler or Alistair MacLean kind of novel title.
Yes, that's what I thought as well. That's not really a good show title, but that's what it was. And then I'm looking at the front page of the script, and it's Larry Stevens' copy, which you've probably got there as well.
Yeah.
It's been replaced with The Sleeping Prince, and The Sleeping Prince really, and there's no relation with the story whatsoever. It just seems to get sledgehammer in there as the title every time. You know, I wonder if just, oh, I've got a recording of some snoring here. Let's all keep up that way.
Here's the thing. It hadn't, until I was listening, until you and I agreed to cover this show, and I listened to the show, obviously, again, and I hadn't listened to it for quite some time. And then I was doing research, and it hadn't occurred to me until now that the Sleeping Prince element bears absolutely no relation to the story. Okay. Mm. I mean, I kind of subconsciously knew that, but I wrote on my notes in capital letters, why didn't the Sleeping Prince element bother me when I first heard the show? If you know what I mean. Why didn't I question what the hell has that got to do with this revolution storyline? And I just wonder why they went with the Sleeping Prince. The only thing is, there's a play by Terence Rattigan called The Sleeping Prince. Do you know about this?
No.
It was written in 1953, and it was written to coincide with the Queen's coronation.
Okay.
And I haven't read the play or read up on the play, but I believe that it was bought by Marilyn Monroe's production company and then adapted for film as The Prince and the Showgirl. Okay, and Larry Olivier had starred in the original play, and as the prince, I presume, and then he also appeared alongside Monroe in The Prince and the Showgirl, of course. Now I don't know from the little bit I read about the play, I can't see any references to South American revolutions or anything like that, so I don't know why or if there was any connection in Larry or Spike's mind when they came to change the title of the show. And all they did is they just added, I think you pointed out to me, they added in, they crossed out bits in the script and in Biro wrote little bits for Wallace to announce at various junctures throughout the show when you would hear this snoring. But yeah, it had nothing to do with the actual plot. And as I always do, I want to give a bit of a context as to what else was happening. Of course, the major story in the news on the 4th of November was the Hungarian, or they did the Hungarian uprising and, yeah, and the Soviet tanks entering Hungary. The day after the show was recorded, the last episode of Son of Fred was broadcast.
Yep, that's right. I'd spotted that as well. But,
Not
that it was broadcast in this area, but parts of England got it. So,
I think it was London, the London area, mainly. It was Associated Rediffusion, wasn't it? Or was it? No, was it? I think networked.
Well, I don't know how much of a network there was at the time, but I believe there were other parts of England got it, but it was before the network was properly developed. So.
Right. Okay. Also, on that day, on the Monday, the 5th, Harry appeared at the Royal Command performance.
All right.
But the Queen pulled out of attending because of the international situation.
Mm.
And on that day, on the Monday, an episode of Desert Island Discs featuring Spike was due to be broadcast, but it was pulled owing to extended news coverage of the Hungarian crisis.
Mm.
And so that episode of Desert Island Discs was broadcast on the 10th of December. And also during that week, Spike did appear on the Light programme on Question Time.
I've seen that. I think that was actually later than that week. I think that was
was it?
I think that was the week the Sleeping Prince eventually was broadcast.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, well, very good for picking up on that. For some reason, I had it down as the week it was recorded.
Question Time, for those overseas listeners might not know it, is a sort of major political TV show now where a studio audience gets to ask politicians of the day questions which they will happily ignore.
Yeah, yeah. They very rarely go off message, do they?
Yeah, but in those days, Question Time was a case of you had a panel of experts on a topic and some of the public would put questions. And on this occasion, the topic was humour. And the audience came from a Middlesex youth club. And the experts were Spike with Joyce Grenfell, who I think you've discussed on the show before, yes, and
yep,
Gerard Hoffnung, who probably you haven't.
No, I haven't. I think I've had a few people talk quite admiringly about Hoffnung, but we've never discussed them in any detail.
Yeah, he's another. It was unfortunate. He died very suddenly in his early 30s, I think, just about 59 or so. He really was a tremendous performer. He was a cartoonist, musician. Classical music was his big thing. Long after he was dead in the mid-60s, Alison Bachelor, along with the BBC, made a series of cartoons in his style, which were called Tales from Hoffnung. Who was the voice talent on some of them?
Spike Milligan.
No, Peter Sellers.
Peter Sellers?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. The best known one is the first one, which doesn't have any voiceover at all. It's a conductor and a concert. But the second one was Peter Sellers was doing a sort of repressed man trying to tell his young son the facts of life.
But right,
there are some of them on YouTube, and it's worth looking out for.
Oh.
Here goes. Come along, my boy. Yes, I think the time has come. I would like to have a talk with you. You see, there are certain facts. Let us face it. Now, look at me. I am your father. am I not? My boy, my boy, my dear, dear boy. We must look at life in a sensible way. No nonsense, no mystery, no enigma. What was I going to say?
What became The Sleeping Prince was recorded on the 4th of November, 56, but it was not actually broadcast until the 14th of February, 1957. Mm. And this is where things get a bit confusing as well. So obviously the international situation had calmed sufficiently that they felt it was permissible to stick out The Sleeping Prince, broadcast it in February 57. It comes out after the week after the mysterious Punch Up the Conquer, and the week before Around the World in 80 Days. And it caused a little bit of, do you know about this, Duncan? It caused a little bit of confusion with the show numbering. I mean, this doesn't really matter to anybody, I suppose, but it's kind of interesting to anal Goon Show fans like me. It internal paperwork designates the show, The Sleeping Prince show, as the 20th episode of Series 7. Because of that, Spike and Larry designated the show that was to follow The Sleeping Prince Round the World in 80 Days as the 21st episode of Series 7. But the problem is that the show is considered to be both the 20th episode of Series 7 and the 6th episode of Series 7. Which means that there isn't, technically speaking, there really isn't a 20th episode.
Series 7. And they all got the week off.
Yeah. it's all very confusing. If people want to find out more about that, then please send me a stamped addressed envelope and I will send you a very lengthy and very boring explanation. Okay. Mm. So the episode itself, I know you pointed out about the script. It's you suspect that Larry was a little bit cheesed off.
Yeah, well,
the rewrites.
He's scored his name out, and there's been an arrow put in the front cover to Pat Dixon's name. So it's supposedly read script by Spike Milligan and Pat Dixon. Pat Dixon was the producer at the time, and it's as if, you know, Pat Dixon was probably working on orders to make some changes to try and get the show through that week.
If you asked me, I would have said, okay, if one of the two writers was going to be temperamental and awkward about this, it would have been Spike. And perhaps he was. We don't know. But it's just that we've got Larry's script to go on, haven't we?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, Pat Dixon's somebody I'd like to know a lot more about, but he does. I mean, he has the reputation of being this great defender of free speech, and so he wouldn't have done anything like that lightly.
No, I guess he was just having to bow to orders from above.
Well, he was obviously trying to get the show out that week, which is his job. So
So what they'd done, so as I say, they've shoehorned in these little references to A Sleeping Prince. They've crossed out references to Civil War, haven't they? And they've just replaced the word civil, or the phrase Civil War, with the word revolution.
Yeah, and they've taken out all references to South America and made it the South Pacific. Just, I dare say, just to make it seem a little less contentious. I mean, nobody, you might think of a revolution in South America, but nobody ever thinks of Fiji having a revolution.
Well, funny enough, in the 80s, I seem to remember Fiji had loads of coups, military coups.
Yeah, probably.
No, but you are right. The South Pacific, certainly at that time, would not have been synonymous with violent uprising. But of course, all they've done is they've just in the script, they've just changed South America to the South Pacific. But we still have characters such as General Gonzalez Mess, who I referred to earlier.
Yeah, that one. Yes, they ran out of the "This isn't Latin America" story at that point, and that was about halfway through, and they probably run out of time changing things. So.
Yeah, I mean, Greenslade does turn up with a French accent towards the end.
As he always does.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. I mean, you could stretch a point and say, wasn't it French Tahiti back in the day?
Tahiti is French, and some of the other Polynesian islands, I think.
My leader El Gobo demands unconditional surrender.
What are his terms?
£5 down and 3 and 9 a week.
Tell him we'll think it over.
I've got this theory about Greenslade and the French accent. I mean, before he joined the BBC, he worked for the P&O shipping line. He was a purser. And I've got this feeling that the French accent may be intended as revenge on every awkward French customer he ever had.
His torturous rendering of the French accent.
Yeah. Yes,
quite possibly. And I suppose, because it's not necessarily a show that gets talked about very much, even in goon circles. But it is famous. If it's famous for anything, it's probably famous for the glorious national anthem.
Absolutely. I think it's 7 times it gets played during the episode. But that is just the highlight.
In 1991, Angela Morley was interviewed and talks about Spike asking for this national anthem, and it's a series, and don't ask me to name all the different instruments that are used, but it's a series of different instruments, and each time they were played, this was played to Spike, he said, no, it sounds too good. He wanted it to sound much more lame, much more off-kilter, I suppose.
It did occur to me once. Oh, I wonder if I could have that played at my funeral. Can you imagine? Curtains open. Coffin disappears through the curtains, heading for the oven, and that's playing.
That'd be great.
It would be a shame not to be able to see it and know what was happening.
Well, it's not that long, though. You might need the 12-inch version of the theme tune, extended version.
Yeah, it's only about 14 seconds or something.
The synopsis for the show, which I have taken from the Transcription Services Variety catalogue.
All right.
Ed Hearn, the lively radio reporter, is sent to cover a dangerous assignment in the Republic of Yakabaku, where the newly elected president, Mr. Neddy Tom Dick Harry Seagoon, is due to be installed. But all is not well, and there are rumours of a coup. President Seagoon is in danger. How his brilliant stratagem saves the situation and his life is revealed in this programme.
There's a stronger plot all the way through this than most shows, I think.
I suppose so.
And it has a proper twist at the end, which was good.
My first criticism, and I'm not going to be too critical about this show, but I don't like the bit right at the beginning where Wallace talks about the big fight.
It's just a lame joke. It's not strong at all. No.
This is the BBC Light Programme. Here is the result of last night's big fight. Patrick O'Donovan, labourer of no fixed address, 6 months. Michael O'Bolligan, fined £5.
Yeah, what they should have done, you should have had him announcing this is the BBC Home Service and then straight into the national anthem.
Yeah.
that's how it should have been.
Yeah, that's really quite a lame joke. Maybe it was original back then, but we've all heard it many times since.
One of the elements of the original broadcast that was cut for the Transcription Services version were references to Christmas.
Yes, right. There was no apparent reason for it being Christmas in the Labour Exchange.
Well, it's recorded in, okay, it's early November, so it's a bit too early. Yeah. I mean, these days it wouldn't be too early for Christmas references.
This is 1956. I mean, I know England's different, but up here, Christmas didn't even become a public holiday until 1958. So,
well, hang on. Sorry, you didn't have Christmas Day off?
No, that wasn't a public holiday until 1958.
Blimey.
Yeah. New Year was the big
Hogmanay's,
tradition.
Hogmanay's much more important, isn't it?
Yeah, and still, well, to this day, Boxing Day is not a public holiday here. It's the 2nd of January.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Labour Exchange, another reference to a Labour Exchange, which Spike was very fond of. In fact, I was watching one of his Q sketches, which was largely set in a Labour Exchange. He's got a real fondness for that conceit, hasn't he? Because again, I suppose and I said this on a previous show when we were talking about insurance, the white man's burden. The phrase Labour Exchange to me just conjures up this rather drab image of a rather pale, sad-faced men sitting in a waiting room waiting to be called, you know? And Neddy arrives, wishing everyone a Merry Christmas. And he's trying to avoid work, I suppose it's fair to say.
He's looking for a job that doesn't involve work.
Yeah. And he's met by Grippipe and Moriarty. So again, it's one of these scams played upon Neddy by Grippipe and Moriarty, isn't it?
Yeah, Moriarty is a minister from the Republic of Yakabaku.
I love the way Milligan pronounces Yakabaku.
Yeah, it bounces about quite a bit, doesn't it, between them?
Yeah. It's almost like Sellers struggles with the word. Because there's a couple of times when Milligan has to say it for him. But I'm not sure if that's just done for comic effect.
I am Count Fred Legs Moriarty. Thank you. An important minister extraordinary to the Republic of Yakabaku.
Yakabaku.
Yes.
Yakabaku.
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 Neddy, you must stop those witty sallies and report to me at once.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Neddy.
So they tell Ned that there's a unemployed job going with money attached. And it is to become the president of this Pacific Republic. It pays £40,000 in Yakabaku money. And then we have Seagoon bound for the South Pacific, and we have Ed Hearn, the American voice that Peter would occasionally assay. I think it was on the Parkinson show that he said that very often he would come up with voices based on the sounds rather than the words. So Hearn, kind of thing.
I think of it as a sort of Voice of America shortwave broadcast that we're hearing.
Yes, it's a very, very authoritative, kind of almost Ed Morrow kind of voice.
Yeah.
This is Station Hearn Hearn of the Hearn Hearn Network. Ed Hearn reporting. Today on board the liner SS Hearn Hearn, arriving at the port of Poncanotus in the Republic of Yakabaku, is the newly elected president, Mr. Neddy Tom Dick Harry Seagoon of London, England, Hearn Hearn of the Hearn Hearn. High hopes are entertained that the installation of this 23-stone president will have a stabilizing effect on the country.
So Seagoon arrives at the port of Yakabaku. He's told that there's a revolution in progress, and he's being shot at, and he's taken to his private chambers, which turns out to be William.
He's from the Battersea Labour Exchange. He's got that job. So obviously just repeating on the joke about people being given jobs in Yakabaku from England.
I didn't check, actually. Did you check in the script? Because there's one point where William talks about, what is he saying? Let me just see my script here. He said, I haven't had any Connor since the revolution started. And I thought that was possibly an ad lib, but was that actually in the original script?
Yes, it is Connor, spelled K-O-N-N-A-H.
Right, okay. I'd never heard of that slang before. Had you heard of that?
Not at all, no.
And all I could find, and I'm not even sure if this is accurate, is that it was army slang for tinned food.
That would make sense, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we go any further, one thing I forgot to ask, we've skipped over Max Galdrey's number.
All right.
With regards to the music in the Goon Show, you know, do you steadfastly listen to every single note or do you skip forward?
I never ever skip forward. I think I possibly did once, as I says, those first Goon shows I had were the EMI recording, which didn't have the music on them. And it was a bit of a surprise when I started getting Goon shows that did, but I may have skipped over once or twice, but it was the days of cassette tape and it was all too much bother. So nowadays, I wouldn't. I'm a big admirer of Max these days anyway. I think he's absolutely terrific. When I was growing up, a mouth organ was a common thing. I mean, I knew two or three people who would always have one in their pocket and would come up with a tune from time to time. But nowadays, I mean, when's the last time you saw a harmonica?
It was probably an episode of I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue from 15 years ago, because Graham Garden used to occasionally pull his mouth organ out.
Yeah.
And when he was doing one song to the tune of another as Bob Dylan or something.
Okay, yeah, aye. Yeah.
A little flourish at the end.
Yeah, because I hadn't heard one for years. And then two or three months ago, I was in Belfast. And there was a fellow busking outside. Is it St. George's Market there? Yeah, and there was a fellow with a harmonica busking. And it was the first time I'd seen one in years.
Buskers these days, they've moved on from the harmonica, haven't they, buskers?
Yeah, but I mean, I admire what Max could do with that instrument. I mean, if you've listened to Bob Dylan's suck and blow style, and people like Max, always he's lifting it almost to concerto level. It's quite remarkable.
I want to ask you as well, because you did mention, I meant to, we kind of got tied up talking about the Hungarian uprising, but you mentioned that you didn't grow up in a house with certainly sort of listening to radio comedy.
Did you
grow up watching TV comedy? Were you into comedy generally when you were a younger man?
I liked it. Comedy wasn't a big thing in our house. I was trying to remember back. We saw some sitcoms, just because there were only really two or three channels at most, so you did. I was a big fan of Harry Worth. His shows were good.
Harry Worth, who's mainly remembered now, I guess, for that window, window thing, isn't he?
Yeah, but he was this fun, bumbling character.
It's funny, though, he's almost completely forgotten now.
Yeah.
Even among people like me, you know, who are into old comedy, really into old comedy, he's never talked about.
Okay, here's a test on old comedy for you. One of the earliest sitcoms I remember seeing was All Gas and Gators.
Yeah.
Did you know that one?
Yeah, I mean, it was a clerical comedy, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the Father Ted of its time.
Was it? I want to say Robertson Hare, was he?
That sounds about right. Derek Nimmo, I think, was the...
Derek Nimmo.
...was the main lead. You had Joan Sanderson as a battle axe wife, who, of course, didn't actually get onto the opening credits.
Did Joan Sanderson play anything other than a battle axe type?
No, not really. No, I don't think so.
No.
But, I mean, All Gas, for those who haven't seen it, All Gas and Gators, imagine Father Ted, but it's set in somewhere in the Church of England. It's for BBC One in the mid-60s. It's all about drinking glasses of sherry, and the main argument seems to be between the Anglicans and the Methodists.
I watched I've watched it at least a couple of episodes over the years with friends, because we watch a lot of old comedy, just general, whatever we can get, you know? And I remember now, Derek Nemo as the young kind of upstart priest, and then you've got Robertson Hare, and I think your man, William Mervyn, is that his name, from Mr. Rose, the television show Mr. Rose.
There was John Barron was in it as well.
John Barron, yes. Okay. That
was the other one. But it wasn't laugh out loud slapstick comedy, that's for sure. One show I remember seeing at one point was the Radio Ham, the Hancock episode, which coincidentally, as Google tells me this morning, that it's the 62nd anniversary of its first broadcast.
Oh, right. But that was
I saw that, but such was my ignorance of things. It wasn't until I was in the 1990s, I was on the internet and there were discussion groups and old radio comedy, I discovered there was actually a Hancock radio series.
Wow. Really?
I missed an awful lot on the things I think of. I hadn't heard any Round the Horn or Navy Lark or Men from the Ministry.
Look, I'm not giving anything away here, because you've already revealed that you were born in late 56. Okay. So you are a gentleman in your 60s.
I am.
But I gather that from what you're telling me, you didn't really discover classic comedy till you were much later in life, really, than most of us would have done.
Yeah, as I said, I was at university when I got that first Goon Show tape. There were two or three other things. There's some Stanley Holloway monologues and things like that. I did like comedy, and I had picked up on a few things. When I was at secondary school, we had a music teacher, and his main target was to get us doing a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta at the end of the year. But he would come up with some a variety of things. And one of the things he introduced us to were Spike Jones and his City Slickers. A couple of months ago now, I lost half a day. I went onto YouTube and put in searches for Spike Jones and Doodles Weaver and just lost half the day watching some of the stuff that's on there. It's absolutely wonderful.
Around the first turn, Stooge Hand is still in front. Cabbage is second by a head.
Cabbage by a head!
Beautiful Linda is third, and Beetlebum. Into the back stretch, Dog Biscuit is now leading the pack. Lady Evelyn is second, very close. Banana is coming up through the bunch.
Banana coming up through the bunch!
And Beetlebum. At the half, Stooge Hand still out in front. Apartment House is second with plenty of room. Assault is passing battery.
Assault and battery!
Notary Sojak is fourth, and in last place by 10 lengths, I believe it is. Yes, it is Beetlebum.
Well, the man who inspired Spike Milligan's pseudonym, wasn't he?
There's arguments about that. Was it Spike Jones or was it Spike Hughes, who was a British jazz trumpeter?
I always thought it was Spike Jones.
Yeah.
And then I've got in my head, I've got Spike Dixon. I'm thinking, Spike Dixon? No, Spike Dixon was in Heidi High.
There was a BBC did a, I think it was BBC Radio, did a documentary about Spike Jones called King of the Cowbells, and Spike Milligan was certainly on that, saying what an influence he was, and so was George Chisholm.
George Chisholm, who presumably, I'm assuming, was part of the Glorious National Anthem Orchestra.
I presume so, yeah. when I was first introduced to the Goons, and I thought, oh, George Chisholm, there's a name I know, at least because he was Scottish and he got written about in Scottish newspapers. So.
Yeah. So back to the show.
Okay.
So Neddy is the newly installed president, and there's the sound of rapid machine gun fire, and Neddy's talking with General Gonzalez Mess, who is leader of both sides in the Glorious Revolution.
Yeah.
And Neddy says, "Hey, somebody shot at me," and Gonzalez Mess says, "It's your imagination." And he says, "Then what are these bullet holes in my bed sheets?" And Gonzalez Mess says, "They are for looking through, senor," which is just gets a great reaction from the audience. And that becomes a bit of a running gag.
He's just continually getting shot at. I mean, earlier on, he was, when he arrived on Yakabaku, he was sent off on a trip through the streets in an open top car while Glyd Pipe and Moriarty followed in an armoured vehicle.
Neddy's then off to the British Embassy because he wants to meet the British Ambassador.
It's Blodnock.
Of course, who else would it be, really?
Yeah.
"Mr. Ambassador, I am the new president."
"Splendid, I'll open a tin of prunes." "Oh, yeah. I'll, great twisted nugglers there early tonight."
"What?"
"The Naughty Revolution, part two."
"You mean they're doing matinees?" "Disgraceful. Fighting after 5 o'clock." "We can't afford to pay them overtime. Commander-in-chief, fall in my army."
"Si, senor, but first, our glorious national anthem."
"No."
"Thank you, senor. Now, Imperial Army of Yakabaku, on parade! Imperial Army, Shem! Present! Ham! Imperial Army, from the right, number!"
"One."
"Hey."
"All correct, senor."
And to me, what follows, which is straight after the Reinte number, to me is one of the greatest Eccles and Blue Bottle sequences in the show's history.
Yeah, it's just a great example of that type, and Blue Bottle gets the best line in the whole show.
Yeah, so we've got Eccles and Blue Bottle, who are the army, the Yakabaku army. They are in the jungle, in the Rebel Howl jungle. Not quite sure what they're doing there. Are they just responsible for guarding the president, basically? Blue Bottle asks Eccles how he got the job of being in the president's army, and Eccles won it in a raffle.
Mm.
And Blue Bottle got his from a cracker at Myrtle Sprigg's birthday party.
Blue Bottle cut his uniform out of the back of a cornflakes packet.
Yes. Yeah.
"Echo, have you ever fired your gun yet?"
"Oh, no. Oh, no."
"Well, let us fire it then."
"Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea."
"You fire then."
"Oh, no, no. You fire the gun."
"No, you're the one with the bullet. You do it."
No, I haven't signed for it. I don't want to do that. I don't want to have any trouble on my hand. I don't want to have
any trouble.
I've been to the doctor and he said, I got nothing. I don't got nothing like that about him at all. I got an uncle in Australia. You be careful what you say to me. I got an uncle in Australia."
"You heard of the Boss Pond Road best shirt wash?"
"No."
"Well then, you watch what you're saying then."
Eccles is trying to intimidate, I suppose, Blue Bottle at one point. And then the only thing he could grasp at is to shout, "I got an uncle in Australia. You be careful what you say to me. I got an uncle in Australia."
Yeah.
And I don't get the bit that Blue Bottle says, but Blue Bottle then counters with, "You heard of the Balls Pond Road best shirt wash?"
I think.
And Eccles says no, and he says, "Well then, you watch what you're saying." I don't get that. Am I missing something there?
Well, the Balls Pond Road comes up a few times over the series. It's just a funny name, I think. I mean, it is a street in London.
Well, it's got the word balls.
Exactly.
I suppose.
Yeah. And I think they're just trying to be silly with it, I think, is the explanation.
And Blue Bottle manages to trick Eccles into firing his rifle.
Echo?
Yeah?
What is that dirty little piece of curved metal sticking out from under your rifle, you?
That? I don't know.
Here, Echo.
Yeah?
Press your finger on it and then see what happens.
Okay. Ow! Oh! Oh, yeah!
Did someone fire a gun at me?
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no.
Then what's this hole in the seat of my trousers?
That's for looking through.
You let me have a look through.
I remember when I first heard this, laughing so much when Neddy says, "What's this hole in the seat of my trousers?" And Blue Bottle says, "That's for looking through." And I laugh so much at that. And then when Eccles says, "Here, let me have a look through." And then there's that perfect pause and he goes, "Ooh." And you hear somebody, I presume it must be Sellers, kind of loses it off mic. And it's just a real deep appreciation of the performance, you know. Mm. I just thought that was such a brilliant little sequence. And I don't quite know. So again, I didn't quite know what this meant when I first heard it, because Eccles is looking through the hole in Ned's trousers and he says there's somebody inside and it's a stowaway and it's Bloodknock. And Neddy says, "Gad, the British ambassador, what were you doing in my trousers?" And in the script, there was something written for him to say, and it's been heavily crossed out to the extent I can't actually read through the crossing out what was said. And then it's just replaced with the word slumming in Biro. And the line slumming got a huge response from the audience, didn't it?
Yeah.
Did it seem... a little bit excessive to you?
Yeah, there may well have been some carry-on going on stage, as there often was.
Yes.
It was quite interesting. One of the articles I published on the website recently was a BBC engineer, a recording engineer, Eddie Mills, and he did a full description of what it was like at a recording. And he talked quite a bit about they would actually use it as technique for some sort of carry-on stage just to get a better laugh. And there were times where they didn't think the sound effect was going to be too effective, so there'd be some sort of visual gag going on at the same time. The audience in the studio might never have heard the sound effect, but the recording had it with the sound effect and a great laugh. So you can never be sure what's going on in the background of these things.
Mm. Bloodknock reveals the sinister plot to assassinate Seagoon and take his wages. And Neddy flees the presidential palace and accepts an offer from the rebels to sleep in their prison free of charge.
Yep.
And we have a rather shoehorned in Minnie and Henry sequence.
Yeah, just
where they're trying to prepare him.
Just get them in for a couple of lines so they've been in the show, and that's about it.
Yeah, and this gets quite dark. They're preparing Neddy for his execution.
Mm.
And Seagoon, as his last request, he asks that they play the glorious national anthem again. But he says, for Plunger Bailey, White, Chunky, Pinhead, and all the lads in Q7 at Battersea Labour Exchange,
yeah,
I'd like you to play your glorious national anthem. Did anything jump out at you, that list of names?
Not specifically the list, no.
Have you ever read Milligan's War memoirs?
I've a long time ago. Are these
right? Okay.
Are these characters from his past?
Wow. Certainly, the name that jumped out at me was Plunger Bailey.
Okay.
Okay. He was in Bexhill on Sea with Spike and and the lads, and he had a celebrated act, if you like, which I'll describe as quite sensitively. It consisted of him performing a series of wedding tackle impressions,
okay,
if you like, such as with titles such as the last turkey in the shop, sausage on a plate, and with the aid of a pair of spectacles, Groucho Marx.
The last turkey in the shop was it the Red Fort episode? Performed.
The last turkey in the shop was a phrase that Spike liked to use a lot. So under the cover of the Yakabakuan national anthem, Neddy makes good his escape, and that is it. It's so hard with these goon shows to do justice to them. Of course.
It's an unusual ending in that all of a sudden Neddy has done something sensible. He's created the diversion, got the whole shooting party to stand to attention, and disappeared while they're doing that. It is unusual.
He's got one over on Gritpipe and Moriarty, which does happen, but not often. And then right at the end, I guess they had to do this because they've been doing it all through the show.
You have just been listening to The Sleeping Prince. Oh, Prince. Prince.
What?
Come on, Prince. Time to go home. And so ends this week's Goon Show.
Again, I just don't know, and it never... I've said it before. It just never occurred to me when I used to listen to this show that there was absolutely no connection. Or what the reason was. I think I may have thought that, because I know at last to go on show, when Angela Morley's interviewed about the national anthem, she describes the country that the anthem is for as being like a Ruritanian country, I think.
Yeah.
Like in The Prisoner of Zender, which would have a crown prince kind of figure.
Yeah.
So maybe that kind of, I'm thinking that there's a prince who's asleep while the president is being shot at, you know, possibly, but...
possibly, but Angela tended not to have a great memory of details from the...
True.
From the Goon Show. She should often say, you'd have to ask Max, because...
That's right.
Because she saw quite a bit of Max Geldry in later years as well, wasn't it?
Of course, this was recorded on the 4th of... November 1956. What happened on the 5th of November 1956?
Well, the Hungarian uprising wasn't the only little war that was going on. And the 5th was the start of, military start of the Suez Crisis. All this moral high ground, oh, we must respect the Hungarian people, was a bit shaky because, should we talk about explain the Suez story?
Yeah, of course, they didn't call it the Suez Crisis at the beginning because that would have been rather foolhardy. But yeah, it was what was to become known as the Suez Crisis.
Yes, it was there was a conspiracy between Israel, France and Britain. And Egypt had nationalised the Suez Canal. Which the British and French had always run and started charging fees for money that they used to build the Aswan Dam eventually. Yeah. And of course, this was seriously increasing the cost of trading with the colonies for the British and French. So the plan was they got the Israelis to invade. So the Israeli army swept down through into the Sinai Peninsula, and then the British and French were going to pretend to be peacekeeping forces, and they would move in, create a demilitarized zone between the Egyptians and the Israelis, which would just happen to follow the line of the Suez Canal.
Mm.
And the Egyptians weren't stupid. Nasser wasn't stupid, saw what was happening, and he just scuttled about a dozen ships in the canal and blocked it anyway.
The British were relying on the Americans coming in
as well. That was part of it. But the Russians were also making threats that if Egypt wasn't let alone, they were going to cause trouble, which I don't know if the Americans wanted any part of it anyway, but that certainly made sure they weren't going to.
Well, it was an embarrassing climb down for Anthony Eden, Prime Minister Anthony Eden, because Eisenhower basically told him that all this had to cease with immediate effect, and it effectively ended his premiership, didn't it?
It did. Eden's. It did. Yeah. Well, Eden had been in Parliament assuring them that there were peacekeeping forces of what we were sending, which was untrue.
Yeah.
But,
lying politicians.
Yeah. And Russia invading countries. Nothing ever changes, does it?
No. And the goons, of course, you know, the Suez Crisis has been reflected in several goon shows and referenced.
But three episodes after the Sleeping Prince was broadcast was Africa Ship Canal. And that was that was a pure satire on the Suez Crisis. You've got an absolutely inept parliament debating the problem with the canal being blocked. You've got grit pipe basically conspiring to steal the canal. And it's as pure a political satire as I think the goons did. And it went down. The BBC allowed it without an argument, apparently, which just shows the state of the country at the time.
Yeah. Well, I've said before, probably on this show, I know I've said it on another podcast, maybe not this, maybe a podcast I've been a guest on, but the Suez Crisis was really the first time that the office of the Prime Minister had been shown to be fallible.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, I suppose, was the first cracks in the deference that the public held towards the establishment and the elites.
Yes. And
the governing classes.
Yes, and Mulligan and Larry Stevens weren't going to miss the opportunity to give the establishment a kicking over it.
Exactly. But then, of course, you know, a few years later, you'd have Lady Chatterley trial.
Suez probably very much accelerated the whole decline in the idea of empire.
Yes, it did.
The British really, at the time, they thought they had the rights to basically rule North Africa. After all the efforts of Spike and Harry in the desert. And a story I came across the other day while I was delving deep into Encyclopedia Gunnicus. Wallace Greenslade played a part in the North Africa campaign.
Where was that? What?
It was Operation Torch, I think, was the original Allied landings in North Africa, out about Algeria and Morocco. At the start of the campaign, Wallace was in the Navy at the time, or the Voluntary Reserve, and he was part of these landings and had his ship sunk from under him. So the story goes.
Blimey.
I'm always pleased to find out little things about Greenslade, and that was one. Came from, do you know who Derek Drower was?
Derek who?
Drower, D-R-O-W-E-R.
No.
He was actually a BBC announcer. He actually did three. He was the announcer in three shows in Series 1.
Was he?
He was, yeah, if you dig deep. But he didn't stay an announcer. He had ambitions to move into management, which he did. But he was a close friend of Wal Greenslade, to the extent that Mrs. Greenslade was godmother to his daughter and such. And it was from him that this story about the sinking came.
Oh, and I'm deeply embarrassed now because I should have at least been aware of the name.
I had seen the name because I had taken loads of data and put it into pages on the GSPS website with, yes, you know, limited details of every show and such. So I'd seen the name, it was in there, but it was only when I was looking for something else the other day I came across that.
Okay.
I was thinking about trying to think of what other, you know, strongly politically satire goon shows there were. I thought of the Tuscan Salami scandal with the Burgess and McLean.
Burgess and McLean, yeah.
And the head of MI5 being depicted as Henry Crun that is most confused.
Yeah. I'm trying to think who the head of MI5 was at the time. Was it Roger Hollis?
Can't remember, but that was the other one that struck me as pure political, well, not pure political satire, but really taking pot shots at the establishment.
Yes. Okay, well, Duncan, listen, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about this very rarely discussed goon show, but, you know, what a sort of history behind it. History in the making as it was being recorded. And it's certainly one that I would recommend to people who haven't listened to it. It's got some great sequences. Blue Bottle Nichols is the standout. And, of course, you have to listen to it, of course, for the glorious Yakabakuin national anthem. So, Duncan, thank you again, and all the best, and we'll talk again sometime soon.
Yeah. Pleasure, pile up. It's a pleasure.